Let's get started. We've been talking in verses 22 through chapter 4, verse 1, about slavery, which is a very difficult topic that I would have, to be honest, preferred to just kind of skip right over, but it's there, and I said we're going through a whole book, and it would look funny if I ducked it, so we're not going to, we decided to take it head on. Now, we said last week that the kind of slavery that we in the West are familiar with is not like the kind of slavery that we see described in the Old Testament. Who's heard of the word chattel? Who knows what the word chattel means? Anyone? Okay, I'll give you the dictionary definition. Chattel means a movable article of personal property. Chattel is a movable article of personal property. And the kind of slavery that most Americans have in their mind is called chattel slavery. For several reasons. One is that it's always involuntary, right? No one in the kind of slavery that we're familiar with from the South and from before the Civil War, no one signed up and said, hey, yeah, take me from my home and my family and put me in chains and ship me across the ocean and make me work for it until I die. No one volunteered for that. It was involuntary. Second thing is it was lifelong. You couldn't just walk away. You couldn't just decide, you know what, I'm quitting. Thanks for the whole slavery thing, but I'm back. I'm going away. You couldn't do that in American slavery. And third, it's dehumanizing because a slave within a chattel slavery system is someone who is, in fact, in several cultures, a slave was defined this way. It's someone who can be used as an instrument. So you use a hammer or a screwdriver and then you put it back in your toolbox, but a slave is like a hammer or a screwdriver, except he can talk and hear commands. That's basically the legal status of slaves in a lot of slave-owning cultures, including the American culture when we had slaves. So when we have this kind of chattel slavery in mind, and we come to Colossians chapter 3, verses 22 through 4, 1, and other passages like it, this isn't the only one. There are lots of them in the New Testament, and we read those and we think this is unjust and horrific. It's horrible. Now, last week we saw that in the Old Testament, the word we translate slave was used to describe both the chattel slave, the person who was ripped from his home and forced to work, right? And it could also be used to describe the person who, being poor, voluntarily goes to his neighbor and says, hey, will you give me a place to live? Will you feed me? Will you take care of my health care until I can get back on my feet? And then you'll let me go in exchange for my work. So in the Old Testament world, both types of slavery, the chattel slavery and this kind of voluntary system of poverty relief is basically what it was, both of them are called, both the people involved in those would be called a slave, right? So there's a problem, we said, in the way the Hebrew uses that word, similar to the problem with our word love. We talked about that, right? Because I can say, I love my socks. And I can say, I love my wife, right? And you know, because you're an English speaker, that I'm not speaking about the same kind of love, right? But we just have one word. That was the Hebrew problem with the word slavery. They just had one word to describe any kind of subordination, any kind of working under a boss. That's what you would do. In fact, if you look at some of the literature from the ancient Near East, you'll find that cabinet members or advisors to kings were referred to as slaves. That's just the way they use that word in the ancient Near East. So what that means is you can look forever. You can look all through your Old Testament. I know you, I'm not sure if you ever have read the Old Testament, but if you have, if you haven't, you can go home and read it today, and you will not find a blanket condemnation of slavery because the word is so broad. What you will find, and what you do find, is explicit condemnations of chattel slavery, of the kind that was going on in the Civil War, in the pre-Civil War. So to frame our discussion today, before bridging over to the New Testament, I want to pull two passages out of the Old Testament just to see this blanket condemnation of chattel slavery there, and that will help us go forward and talk about New Testament slavery. The first text I want to remind you of, I think we looked at it last week, but I'll remind you of it this week. You don't have to look it up if you don't want to. You can if you do. Exodus chapter 21, verse 16. Listen carefully. Whoever steals a man and sells him, and anyone found in possession of him shall be put to death. All right, so let's just think through this. Anyone who steals a man who's free and makes him a slave and then sells him, but then also anyone who has possession of someone who has been involuntarily forced into slavery can be put to death. Should be put to death. So even if you're just the buyer of someone enslaved against his or her own will, you are subject to the ultimate penalty. That's taking a man who is free, making him a slave, and possessing someone against their will. That is a great definition of chattel slavery. And it's forbidden right there in Exodus 21, verse 16. And that governs all the slave-master relationships you read about in the Old Testament. You can't, as an Israelite, hold someone against their will. You can't force someone into slavery. The only way it's possible for someone to work for you is if they volunteer to do it. Okay, so the next passage I want to bring your attention, or to call to the forefront of your mind as we move into the New Testament, is Deuteronomy 23, verses 15 through 16. Again, you don't have to look it up, but it's nice to have on hand. Deuteronomy 23, verses 15 through 16, and let me read it to you. You shall not give up to his master a slave who has escaped from his master to you. He shall dwell with you in your midst, in the place that he shall choose within one of your towns, wherever it suits him. You shall not wrong him. So let's say an Israelite decides to break Exodus 21:16 and take a guy who is free, make him a slave, or buy a slave and keep him, but the guy manages to escape. The minute he escapes, under the law of God, he is totally free. I mean, he was free before. He shouldn't have been held, but then he's free. And then, since he's free, he takes on the status of a free man. If you go after him and try and catch him again, you're enslaving him. And so it goes right back to the Exodus 21:16 law, and you're subject to death again. And get this, this is what's fascinating about this. If anybody in Israel runs into an escaped slave, they're obligated by the law not only not to turn him into his master, but also to let him live wherever he wants and dwell wherever he wants and not harass him and not do him evil, and within this kind of hospitality code that would include defending him against any attempts to get him back. So this is wonderful for anyone in Israel who happens to be illegally a slave, but it's also wonderful for anyone outside of Israel, like in Assyria or Babylon, who knows that if I can just get out, if I can get out from under my master's hands and get to Israel, I'll be free. Now, I wonder why God would set up a system like that. I wonder why God would set up a system before all the nations of the world, where slaves, wherever they lived, knew, if I can just get to the covenant people, if I can just get to Israel, I'll be free. I wonder why God would set up a system like that. Okay, so these two laws together make forcing people into bondage and selling them like property illegal, or keeping them against their will illegal. Did it happen? Yes, people break the law all the time. But it happened apart from the law, not under the law. Okay, so that's the framework for Paul's understanding and for the understanding of all the Jewish guys who wrote the New Testament. That's the framework. That's how they understand God's purposes. God's purpose is to create a covenant people where the poor are liberated from poverty and those who are in slavery are helped out of bondage. That's their mindset. That's Paul's mindset. So you read Colossians 3, 22 through 4, 1, and immediately it seems like, what happened between Old Testament and New Testament? Well, let's talk about it. All right, let's do think about slavery in Paul's day. Now, Rome is not Israel, right? So Rome isn't bound by the Old Testament law of God. Rome's its own place. Rome is Rome. In Rome, slaves were legally property. In the ancient republic, this is before Paul's day, but in the ancient republic, the male head of the household, of any household, had the power of life or death over everyone living within his home. So if he decided to kill his son, he could do it. No questions asked. He is the head of that household. He has that power. And the same, of course, is true for the slaves within the male head of the household's household. If he wants to beat them, he can beat them. If he wants to kill them, he can kill them. If he wants to sell them, he can sell them. If he wants to overwork them, he can overwork them. Legally, he has absolute authority over his slaves. That's the law in the ancient republic. By Paul's day, there were some laws that were kind of helping the slaves out, but it was still legally a pretty, pretty bad system. But the experience on the ground of slavery was not uniform. I mean, it wasn't the same everywhere. There was a very huge difference between the kind of slavery that would have been experienced in the mines, in the fields, and in the Colosseum for gladiators, for example, and the kind of slavery that you would see experienced by people in urban settings, household slaves, people who were living under the authority of a wealthy Roman in a town. Two very different worlds. In the one on this side, the chattel slavery, that did look very much like what we would think of as slavery in our own context. The one difference being there was no racial component to it, right? It wasn't like they were looking for black people or brown people. Anybody could be a chattel slave in the ancient world. That wasn't a problem, except a Roman citizen, which we'll get to in a minute. So on the one side, there's a really bad situation, okay? And on the other side of the coin, life wasn't quite so bad. And in fact, we're going to see in some cases it was better than being free. And let me just go ahead and describe some facts about people who were living in an urban setting. Now, if you have your Bibles, go ahead and open them, if you haven't already, to Colossians 3, if they're not already open, and look there. And notice, if you will, that when Paul addresses slaves, he does so after he addresses husbands and wives and fathers and children. Do you see that? And then he goes right into slaves and masters. You might think, what an odd connection. Well, it's not an odd connection in an urban setting where most slaves are living in the household of their master. And we know that all churches in the first century were begun in an urban setting. So Paul, we can be sure, was not addressing the chattel slavery of the mines or the gladiators or the other kind of chattel slavery. He was addressing the household kind of slavery that we're about to describe. Okay, that's where it fits. All right, let's talk about it. So most urban slaves served in the homes of very well-off people. They were employed generally as cooks, as cleaners, as tailors, as tutors, they could be economic advisors, they could be treasurers. Some masters would train their slaves to be good businessmen and have them run and manage all of their affairs. It was really economically wise for a master to have his slave very well educated so he could take care of some of these more mundane administrative matters. So you could have, in that setting, a very well-educated slave. Now, that already is very different, if you want to think about it, from the American kind of chattel slavery system. Secondly, all slaves were able, under the law, to own property. You could, most were able by a certain point in their lives to buy their own freedom because they were able to amass wealth being a slave. Now, no slave in the American world would be able to own property, but you could as a Roman slave. And in fact, some of them got so rich that they owned their own slaves. You have slaves owning slaves, and it could even go further down, and the slaves who were owned had other slaves. So it was a weird system, not one that we're familiar with. Okay, next. Masters were obligated socially. Now, we already said legally they didn't have any obligation to their slaves, but socially they were obligated to feed, clothe, and cover health care costs for slaves until they died or until they were freed. This is not bad food and bad clothing and bad shelter. Like, if you think about, go back to to the American experience, you think of the shacks and the shanties outside of the big plantation. That's not what was going on in the urban setting in Rome, and I'll tell you why, because the Roman mindset was, my slave is like my Mercedes, right? Or my Porsche. So they were used as ways of demonstrating their own wealth. So if a Petronius has a slave going out into the world, he's going to dress him well. He's going to feed him well. He's going to keep him healthy. Because what does that say about Petronius? He's a powerful guy. He's a wealthy guy. He's a rich guy. He's able to take care of his slaves well. The guy who has the slaves in rags on chains looks like what's wrong with that guy? He's driving a clunker around. That's kind of the way people in Rome would have seen it. I'm not saying it's good that these guys held their slaves to be like their Mercedes. I think that's bad. That's evil, obviously. But it does mean that for slaves in an urban setting, they would have been treated fairly well, or else their master would have looked bad. They could expect food, clothing, and health care. Now, freeing slaves, this is an interesting thing. Freeing slaves was customary and common, and most slaves could expect to be freed by their 30th birthday or shortly thereafter. So you would be held in slavery from about 10, or you'd be working for your master about 10 until about 30, and then you'd be freed, generally. And we'll see why in a minute. Okay, here's another thing. Any foreign person who became a slave and then was released by his master, upon release, he immediately gains Roman citizenship, full Roman citizenship. Right, so if you're from Ethiopia and you're in Rome, you're low on the totem pole. But if you're made a slave and you go through and you get freed at some point in your life, then you have full Roman citizenship, which is huge. Remember, Paul appealed over and over again to his Roman citizenship to get him out of all sorts of trouble. He was chained, remember, by the Romans, and he was held in jail. And then he said, oh, wait, did I mention that I'm the citizen of no mean city? And by that he meant Rome. And the centurion jumped. He said, oh, I'm sorry, let me get you out of these chains, because it was illegal to hold a Roman citizen in chains who hadn't been tried and convicted. So Paul was able to use that. Roman citizenship carried with it a lot of privileges and social advantages. Freed slaves automatically elevated themselves into that status. Being a household slave was the quickest way for a free poor person to move up on the social and economic scale. Because you'd be educated, you'd be trained in a skill or profession, and while at the same time you'd be receiving room and board and health care, and then when you were freed, which you could expect normally, you could be almost assured of employment, because then when you're freed, your master becomes your patron. Remember our discussion of patronage? And he would be obligated either to give you a job or to find you a job. Okay, so knowing all of this, some poor, free, non-Roman citizen Romans voluntarily put themselves into bondage. They voluntarily stepped forward to be slaves, either because they couldn't take care of themselves, there's no social security, there's no welfare, you're just out there by themselves, either because they couldn't take care of themselves or because they wanted to get ahead in the world, get a profession, get trained, make some connections, and get out a Roman citizen and free. Now, here's another factor that we need to remember. Roman fathers, as I said a minute ago, had basically a carte blanche. They could do anything to the members of their household. And one thing that was rather common is that when your wife had a baby and you realized that, you know what, this is one too many kids, I can't afford it. So what they would do is something called exposure. They would take their baby out to a designated spot, lay it on the ground, and walk away. It was legal to do that. A Roman father had absolute authority to command his wife to do it, and she would have to do it. Right? Now, that baby would either die there, because no human life was cheap in those days in the Roman Empire. The baby would either die there, or anyone walking past could pick up that child and take him or her to his or her home and either make him or her a slave or a son or a daughter. They could adopt them. Now, the reason lots of people didn't adopt exposed children is because they had kids of their own and they wanted to preserve their inheritance rights for their kids. So the most common way of taking exposed children and having compassion on them was to pick them up off the side of the road and make them your slave. Right? So slavery was often a way for Romans to save exposed infants. It's amazing. Now, I don't want to paint too rosy a picture. It's not rosy, don't get me wrong. Because there were many horrible and cruel masters. Because remember, as a slave, you are the property of the one who owns you, and so you are vulnerable to be abused, and you aren't free. You can't just say, hey, I've had enough, and quit and go away. You are stuck there, and it might be good now, but tomorrow your master could have a change of heart and start beating you. You don't know. You're there, and you're vulnerable to him. So it wasn't a great system. And it wasn't God's Old Testament anti-poverty system, but also I think we can see that neither was it the kind of slavery we think of when we think of New World slavery. And I hope you can also see why the New Testament doesn't approach slavery with a blanket condemnation. But there's more. Freeing slaves, as we said a minute ago, we didn't say this, but freeing slaves also stood as kind of a status symbol, right? So imagine like today, someone giving away his Cadillac or giving away his Mercedes. You know, well, here, have my Mercedes. What does that say about the person who does it? He's generous and he's rich enough to be able to give that stuff away, right? Same kind of thing operated with giving freedom. That's why most wealthy people released almost all of their slaves before they died, but they would maybe leave some to their kids, but most slaves could expect by the age of 30 to be released. But there was another reason for giving freedom, and a more malicious reason for giving freedom. Slaves were expensive. Right? You got to care for the guy's food, you got to care for the guy's clothing, you got to care for the guy's health care, right? What happens when the guy gets old? Healthcare is more expensive, and what can't he do? He can't work. What happens if the guy breaks his leg? There you go. It's like having a Mercedes with no tires. What are you going to do with it, right? Nothing. Right. So what masters would do when this happens sometimes is they would free their slave. There you go. You're free. Off you go. And often that would lead to starvation and sometimes death. So granting freedom in some cases is a way of exposing old and sick people. I think now especially we can see why a New Testament blanket condemnation of all slavery wouldn't work. It wouldn't be good, in fact. Because some masters would free slaves to avoid the obligation of caring for them, and with freedom could possibly come death. So if Paul were to say every Christian master must free his slaves, it would have freed masters from their obligations to care for the old and the infirm. He wasn't about to do that. Okay, so slavery in Paul's day varied from case to case. You could have the chattel slavery, or you could have the kind of career training, social security kind of slavery. There was no uniform way to address it without hurting lots of people. You just couldn't do that. Now, recognizing that, let's see what the New Testament does say. Okay. First, let's go ahead and open to Ephesians 6. I had you mark that. First, the New Testament rejects the idea that one human being is the owner of another. Chapter 6, verse 9, Paul, speaking to masters of slaves, says, hey, you be just and you be good to your slaves. Why? Knowing that he who is both their master and yours is in heaven, and there is no partiality with him. Now remember, in Roman thinking, in Roman law, a slave is the property of his owner and the sole authority over what happens to that guy. And Paul says, no, your slave's owner is Jesus, and guess what? Your owner is Jesus too. You both have the same master. You don't own your slave. Jesus does. And he owns you too. You see this very clearly in 1 Corinthians chapter 7. So I know you had that marked. Why don't we go ahead and look there too. 1 Corinthians chapter 7, verse 22. He who is called in the Lord as a bondservant. Now the word there is doulos, which is slave. I don't know why they translated bondservant. He who is called in the Lord as a slave is a freedman of the Lord. Likewise, he who is free when he is called is a bondservant of the Lord. So masters, again, your master Jesus has freed your slave. He is a freedman. He is your brother. You don't own him. And you are owned by Christ. So what Paul does here is he begins by leveling the playing field. The same thing we saw going on in the Old Testament law. God says that your poor brother is your poor brother. And so you care for him. You don't abuse him. He is the Lord's, and so are you. So you take care of him. The same thing is being said in the New Testament. Someone comes to Christ. Christ has set him free. You don't own him. Christ owns both of you. Second thing the New Testament says about slavery is this. And we can see it right there in 1 Corinthians 7. The New Testament understands all bondage, which is what the Roman system was. Remember, bondage is being held against your will. Understands all bondage, even the bondage people enter voluntarily, as an evil. How do I know that? Well, look down at verse 23 in chapter 7. Paul tells people, first of all, don't enter it. Look, if you can't avoid it, I guess you have to, but make every effort to remain free. Don't put yourself in a position of bondage to get ahead. Don't do it. If you can make a living outside of slavery, do it. Don't get in. And then in verse, I think it's 21, if you can get out, leave. Get out. Now, how do I know that that sets slavery in the context of something that is evil and must pass away? Well, because compare it to what Paul says, for example, about marriage. He says, wives, submit to your husbands. Husbands, love your wives. One thing he doesn't say is, don't get into it. Don't get into marriage. And then if you can get out, do it quick, right? totally different context there when we're talking about marriage and slavery. Slavery is an evil thing you shouldn't try to get into, and if you can, you should try to get out. That's very clear there in chapter 7 of First Corinthians. Okay, third. Now, the New Testament does call slaves to obey masters. Even, you'll see in other texts, non-Christian, cruel masters. But the analogy for that is the call that you and I both have to obey those set in authority over us. In Romans chapter 13, Paul says all Christians are to obey those who are set in authority over us, even if they're unjust. I mean, Paul wrote Romans chapter 13 during the reign of which emperor? Who knows? Nero. Cruel, unjust, horrible, right? But Paul says, hey, you got to obey him. Now, there's one limit to that obedience. There's one limit to that obedience. Who knows what that is? Anyone? In your job, in your life in America, wherever you are, I don't care what your life is like, if ever anyone in authority over you commands you or tells you to do something that God says not to do, or says not to do something that God has told you to do, you can say, no, I'm not going to do that. That applies to every Christian in every place. So, and that applies to masters and slaves. Slaves are not to obey masters unto the death, right? They have a place where they can say no, as we do for anyone in authority over us. So the master who says, you know what, I want you to go ahead and be a gladiator and be trained in the sword and learn how to kill people for a living, and you're my slave, so you have to do it. The slave can say no. He might die, but he can say no. The command that Paul gives for slaves to obey masters does not extend to disobeying God. Okay, fourth, the New Testament crushes the notion that slaves are less human than free people, and that was a common prejudice. Well, they're slaves because, well, they're lesser human beings than we are, and we know they're lesser human beings than we are because they're slaves. That's kind of the way the reasoning went. Now, go ahead and turn back to Colossians 3 for a minute, and I want to show you something. Look at verse 11 in Colossians 3. Paul writes there, here there is not Greek and Jew, circumcised and uncircumcised, barbarian, Scythian, slave, free, but Christ is all and in all. What's the here in that text? Who knows? In Christ, right? In the church, in Christ. So in the Christ, there's no, all the prejudices that the average Greek Roman person would carry into the church. The barbarians are horrible people. The Scythians are horrible people. I'm better than those slaves because I'm free. All of that, Paul says, no. No, not in the church. Slaves are no less human than masters are. Masters are no less human than free people are, than slaves are, all the way through all the prejudices that existed in the time. Paul levels the field. And in fact, so much so that we have records that in the first century and the second century, masters would go to church and they would come and, I guess, sit down. I don't know if they had pews or not, but they would come and sit down, and then their slaves would get up from behind the pulpit and start preaching. You know why? Because they were their pastors. Right? So you would have these relationships where they would be under, the masters would be under the slaves' authority in the church, and then they would go home and the slave would work for the master. It's kind of an interesting leveled playing field there. All right, well, we've seen why a blanket order to free all slaves would have caused lots of death and starvation. But where it was possible, freedom, masters granting freedom, was the expectation. It was expected in the church that if you could free your slaves without hurting them, you're supposed to do it. How do I get that? Well, I don't want you to turn here, but when you get home, if you want just a short read, you can open your Bibles to the book of Philemon. And Philemon was a slave owner, and one of his slaves was named Onesimus. And Onesimus escaped his bondage, and he found somehow Paul. Paul preached the gospel to Onesimus, Onesimus believed the gospel and became a Christian, right? Paul sits down to write a letter. He sits down to write a letter to Philemon. He also, at the same time, is writing this letter that we're reading to the Colossians and to the Ephesians. And in this letter to Philemon, he says the following. I'm sending you, Onesimus, once a slave, now a brother. Once he was a slave, now he's your brother. He is my very heart. Now, I could order you to do what is required, and that's the language, and release Onesimus, but I'm sending him to you confident that you'll do the right thing. Oh, he says, and by the way, prepare me a room because I'm coming over to visit, right? So here's Paul, the apostle of Jesus Christ, saying to Philemon, you know what? You need to release your slave because now he's your brother and he's my very heart. I'm sending him to you and I'm not going to command you to release him, but I am confident that you're going to do the right thing and I'm coming to visit. Prepare it for me. It was the expectation in the first century church that slaves who could release masters would do so and without hurting them would do so. All right, sixth, and this is probably the most important. And if you have your Bibles marked in 1 Timothy, go ahead and turn there. 1 Timothy 1, verse 10. Remember those two passages from the Old Testament that we looked at the beginning of this sermon, from Exodus 21 and Deuteronomy 15? The Exodus 21, verse 16's condemnation of chattel slavery is brought forward into the New Testament. We'll see it here. Verse 10. Among those that Paul regards or Paul lists as ungodly, you will find the word enslaver. You see that? Everyone see it? The NIV has the word slave trader. That's wrong. It's a bad translation in Greek. It's transliterated. It could be transliterated as man stealer. The very same concept that's there in Exodus 21:16. It refers not just to a slave trader, but anyone who takes and holds another person in bondage against his or her will. Right? So anyone who says that the New Testament doesn't condemn slavery, this is a great place to go because, yes, it does. You can't hold anyone in bondage against their will and be a Christian. If the person wants to go, you got to let them go or else you're an enslaver. You're holding them against their will. Okay, so let's pull back. The slave owners in America did not use the Bible to support slavery. I hope we can see that they abused the Bible to support slavery. They took passages that were in a very specific historical context and they ripped them out of that context and they used them as a pretext to oppress and dominate other people. That's what they did. What Paul has done and what we see in the New Testament and the Old Testament together is put back together the community that was broken at the fall. When human selfishness and poverty, the selfishness driven by poverty, led one person or more people to dominate others, that is being reversed in the church. No one can own another person. No one can take another person's freedom away. If you're a master and your slave wants to go, let him go. If he needs help, help him. Very same command we see in the Old Testament is brought forward in the New Testament. God is putting the human community back together. Those in authority must treat everyone under them as brothers. Now, and our call in the world is to do this, is to take the model that we're given in a system, within a context, a historical system, a context in which there was no, remember, economic safety net over people's heads to help them. We're to take this model that Christ gives, that Paul gives to the church for helping the poor and freeing the captives and freeing the slaves. We're to take that and make that reality in this church and throughout the world. That's what the New Testament is all about. That's what the book of Acts is all about. It's about the church, the apostles, the followers of Jesus, spreading the gospel from city to city, from place to place. And as they do, slaves, masters, Scythians, barbarians, people from all nations and peoples can come in and be freed from bondage, freed from poverty, freed from need. Now, I asked the question at the beginning when I was talking about Old Testament slavery, why do you think God would have created a system like this? What's he doing? What's he doing? He's painting a picture, isn't he? He's painting a picture for everyone in the whole world of a much deeper reality. Not only does the church, not only does the covenant community free those who are held in material bondage, but Jesus Christ frees you from the bondage of sin and brings you liberty, freedom. Right? That's the picture. If you're in bondage, if you want escape, if you want freedom from addiction, freedom from the sins that oppress you and drive you to do what you shouldn't do, come to Jesus Christ. He can break those chains and set you free. That's the point. Okay. Now, we're going to close here, and I'll ask you just to think, as we do, about several things. We don't have slavery as we had in the Old South in America anymore, but we do have slavery. Did you know that? Did you know that in some places in the world, women and men, parents, sell young girls into bondage to be sex slaves, and they're trafficked? We're not just talking about places like Thailand and other places that with people who aren't like us. We're also talking about in America that happens. Every once in a while, you'll hear of a child sex ring that involves real child prostitutes. Those aren't women who have decided to give their life to prostitution. Those are slaves. One of the problems with the undocumented aliens that we have coming into the country, which is they need to because they need to find food. But what happens because they're undocumented is that farmers and people who are raising crops will take them, and because there's no accountability to how they're treated because they're undocumented, they can basically be treated as slaves. So don't think that this problem is something that was way back in the past and irrelevant to us. It's not. Slavery exists today. And just as strongly and as vigorously as it was opposed by William Wilberforce and others, it needs to be opposed by us. And I'll stop here. The Lord be with you.